You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science and Sport. Today we are in Alpe di Susi.
Cozze ci delle cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora.
Vincenzo Nibali slumped over on the fence. Obviously not a good day for him. A massive scrum, as always, at the finish line. He hasn't really got room to breathe here. Shaking his head, not happy at all. He doesn't want to speak to anyone. Well, Esteban Chavez is smiling, as he always is. Let's see what he has to say. I think he's up to second on general classification. We're waiting for the results to come through. But yeah, big contrast between his mood and Nibali's.
I'm not pushing too much in the beginning. It's not true. I'm pushing all the 30 minutes. It's long 30 minutes. After these two stages on the mountain, today is really, really hard. But we are really happy. We did the maximum we can. And this is the result.
I don't know the results now. I don't know what is my position in the general classification, but we continue with the same idea. Stay with the feet in the hair. We're going with the same idea for have one Orica Greenwich and one Esteban Chavez competitive for 3 weeks.
I'm tired. I'm really tired, and everyone is really, really tired, but we are really happy. After 2 weeks, Orica Greenwich have really good results. Thank you very much, and all team. After the won the Queen stage, you have really good memories. But we sleep well. We sleep happy. Today, wake up happy, and try to do the best. No, okay. This is the life.
Matt, you must
can
be.
Can you tell me how much time did Vincenzo lose?
To him,
a minute and a half to him.
Probably a bit less, I think.
Okay. So what's the GC now? He's second now. By how much? I was told we're in second, but I want to see. Yeah, no, he's taking a minute and a half out of him. He's 30 seconds. He's 40 behind, and he's 40 in front.
Kreuzwick gained as well.
Yeah.
Matt, he seems to start relatively slowly, which I suppose wasn't really a surprise on this kind of course. Was that the strategy?
It was. Look, he's not the biggest of the guys, so obviously the first couple of kilometres is going to suit the bigger climbers. Because there was parts there where they're doing 50, 60 kilometres now. I'd like to see the splits, but he was certainly one of the fastest when we actually hit the proper climb.
And he said he is tired, but you got any concerns about how he's going to last over the remaining few days?
Look, I'd be concerned if he wasn't tired. After yesterday, that was an incredible day. He put a lot of effort into today. And you saw a couple of guys today, apart from Kreuzwick, who went very, very hard at the start, and they certainly paid for it in the final couple of kilometres. So I think he's ridden a very intelligent time trial. And look, we've gained time. We've still got a lot of climbing to go.
Does he ever stop smiling?
Yeah, when he's asleep.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and that last voice you heard was Orica Greenedge sports director Matt White talking to Daniel Freeb at the finish line of stage 15 of the Giro d'Italia, just checking with Daniel whether his rider Esteban Chavez had in fact moved up to second place overall. And Daniel, you were able to tell him that Chavez is now lying second in the Giro.
And I must say, Lionel, Matt White was smelling absolutely exquisite tonight after Garlic Gate of 2 days ago. More importantly, dove siamo?
We're in the very chilly Dolomite Mountains, aren't we, at Alpe di Susi. I've borrowed a jacket from one of our guests this evening because I've dressed very unwisely for the conditions. It was lovely and warm down in Castelrotto this afternoon, so I wore shorts and a t-shirt. It's really quite cold up here now, isn't it?
Not the only cock-up we've made today, it has to be said.
Oh, we've had a shocker today, haven't we? We've driven unnecessary kilometres on the motorway, we got lost, we've had to drive across country, we had to take a cable car up here to the finish. We've left all sorts of things back at the hotel.
I mean, other than that, we're a very professional outfit, aren't we?
We are. We don't want to look too bad in front of our guests, who are consummate professionals on television, working for the host broadcasters, commentating on the world feed. This evening, we're joined by Dan Lloyd. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
And Ned Bolting.
Hello. Lionel.
Right. Well, we'll talk to Dan and Ned in more detail a little bit later on, but first of all, let's run through the stage, the tail of the tapper. Stage 15, a 10.8 kilometre mountain time trial from Castelrotto to Alpe di Susi in Dolomites. Not an awful lot of changes of lead today, but a significant result. The main leaders in chronological order were Alexis Rybalkin of Gazprom Rosvelo, who finished 22nd in the end. Then Ian Boswell of Sky beat his time, and Boswell finished up 15th. And then it was Alexander Folofarov of Gazprom. He was the eventual winner with a time of 28 minutes 39 seconds. Folofarov was lying 58th this morning, an hour and 33 minutes behind Krauswijk overall. Stephen Krauswijk of Lotto NL Jumbo still has the pink jersey, and in fact, he has extended his lead. He was last to start the time trial, and he pushed Folofarov very close and was less than a second slower on the line, and that meant the Dutchman has gained on all of his rivals and stretched his lead to 2 minutes 12 over Esteban Chavez of Orica Green Edge. Everybody else lost time, but the biggest loser of the day was Vincenzo Nibali, who had a bit of a shocker, lost 2 minutes 10. His chain slipped at one point, he had to stop, he tried to sort it out himself, then he changed bikes, and he also had some problem with fans running alongside him too close. So great day for the Dutchman, and he has a handy advantage with a week to go. He's in pink, Nizzolo is still in red, Cunego in blue, Bob Jungels in white, and tomorrow is a rest day.
We heard there from a kind of pagan band, I think it was playing outside our hotel in a place called Vuls am Schlern. Everything, of course, here is bilingual, or mainly German, actually, but German being the first language for most people in this part of Italy, which I know you found very odd, Lionel. Some very evocative sounds there, first thing in the morning. Very enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to some kind of sauerkraut pizza or something this evening. That would be nice, wouldn't it, to sign off my last day on the Giro. And it was a great day to finish with. Mountain time trial. It's really cemented Stephen Krauswijk's lead in the pink jersey. But first of all, let's talk about the stage winner. A surprise package, a bit like a non-league side knocking a Premier League side out in the third round of the FA Cup. Dan, what did you make of the stage winner today, the Russian Alexander Folofarov?
It was certainly a surprise. I think if you'd have penciled down a number of riders who could have won today's stage, he wouldn't have been penciled at all. He would have been quite some way down the order. But although he was a surprise, when you do look into what he's done previously after the stage and also think about changing conditions that might have favoured him, he actually has got quite a good history as an under 23 and sounds like he's someone that does really well on a single climb, even if he doesn't manage to do it climb after climb. And as Ned was telling me before the race started here at the Giro, he was commentating on the Giro del Trentino and he was on the attack with Vincenzo Nibali and some other stars in that race. So he's obviously got a decent pedigree behind him at the races like the Tour de l'Avenir and the Giro d'Aosta, which are, you know, very good indications for under 23s of future performances. So yeah, a little bit of a surprise, but maybe it shouldn't have been too much of a surprise.
Well, just run through a little bit of his history, Alexander Folofarov. Probably the first notable result he had was in the European Road Race Championships in 2013, the under 23 road race. It was held in the Czech Republic, and he was in a five-man break that decided that race. The winner was Sean Deby, who's riding here at the Giro for Lotto Soudal. Also in there was Tom Skuins, the Cannondale rider who won at Lake Tahoe in the Tour of California earlier this week, and Julian Alaphilippe, who's leading the Tour of California, and Petr Vakoc of Etix Quickstep, who's had some big results. So he's in some handy company there. He's also been fourth in the Tour de l'Avenir. Last year, he was the winner of the Tour of Sochi in Russia. And the year before that, the winner was Ilnur Zakarin. So, you know, there you can see kind of a pattern of pedigree behind Folofarov's results.
I was about to say, Lionel, if someone had said that a Russian was going to win today's stage, you would have put plenty of money on Ilnur Zakarin, wouldn't you? And Gazprom not having ridden particularly well so far in this Giro, their selection as a wild card was fairly controversial, fairly contentious, and they haven't been too prominent, have they? And they needed a performance at least, and the victory came as a big surprise.
It impressed me more than anything else, and now I'm reflecting on, you know, the television pictures that Dan and I have just commentated on, was the way he attacked the final kilometre, which is unlike anybody else, actually. Even when the favourites came up and over the line, it looked like everyone else was kind of on the limit. But Folofarov was sprinting in the final 300 metres or so, and he absolutely slammed past Stefan Kung, who was his, probably not his minute man, he was his third minute man. I mean, he'd gone past so many on the road, and he'd set, was it the ninth or tenth best time at 4.4 kilometres? So he was nowhere near the fastest over that flatter couple of K to the Czech, and then he just accelerated, and it was a frustration, wasn't it, of the way that inevitably coverage sort of is dictated by the number of cameras you can put on the race. But we didn't really see what he'd been up to, except the occasional glimpse of him from the helicopter, until those closing couple of hundred metres. And it was extraordinary how fast he was there.
Maybe he took the cable car like us. I mean, if there were no cameras on him, how can we be sure that he actually rode the whole route?
I was speculating whether he, because it was quite a sinuous course, wasn't it, with lots of hairpin bends, whether he'd just kind of cut a corner and gone cross-country and sort of like, you know. But it was remarkable, and it looked to me like he could have done with a few more kilometres of climbing because he was so fresh at the finish.
What we did see, which you two might not have seen, having got up here to the finish so late today, was his teammate Fursunov, who ended up fourth place today in the time trial. He was up there on GC for quite some time before dropping out a couple of days ago. But he was actually held up for quite some time behind the Tinkoff car because they didn't pull over in time and the crowds were quite thick where they were trying to pass through. So he actually had to come to a complete stop at one point before the crowds allowed him to go past the Tinkoff car. Otherwise, he probably would have been third place himself.
I think, I suppose, the other thing is that riders like Filipov, not that they've had an easy few days, but they haven't been in the position where they've had to race and follow every wheel. He was quite well down on the previous day's stage, so has that advantage over all of the main riders, which I suppose then makes Stephen Krauswijk's ride quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, to almost win the stage a second away from doing so without that late spurt by Filipov that you're talking about, Ned, Krauswijk would have won the stage and really put a huge seal on this Giro.
Well, Lionel, today I saw two absolute eyesores. One was Stephen Krauswijk's pink all-in-one, which we thought the days of those all pink skin suits were done and dusted. We were never going to see that again. Unfortunately, we did today. Doesn't really go with his freckly sort of red-headed or ginger complexion, does it? The other one was, did you see the Roberto Baggio fan running alongside Vincenzo Nibali holding him up? The worst thing about that was his hair was rather like mine, but it should really have been in a divine ponytail, wasn't it? And it was flapping around all over the place. But Krauswijk is clearly absolutely zinging, isn't he? I mean, he said yesterday in the press conference that he was only going as well, in his opinion, as he had last year. But I think he's being a bit disingenuous there. I think he's in the form of his life.
Well, he said exactly that in the press conference. He said he's in the form of his life, and clearly today confirmed it. Still a long way to go and a lot of climbing to go, but is in a fantastic position, isn't he? 2 minutes 12 is a lot to make up, and particularly when Vincenzo Nibali lost a couple of minutes. I mean, he's tumbling away from the overall. We were worrying with an inexperienced Grand Tour leader. We were worrying that if the main challenge had to come from another inexperienced Grand Tour rider, that it might be a sort of a done deal.
Dan, you surprised by Krauswijk's performance? I mean, you wouldn't have backed him before this Giro, would you?
Well, last year he was incredible. If you take out the first week from the equation, then I think he only lost about 20 seconds to Contador over the final 2 weeks of the race. So he was obviously on very good form last year, but lost unnecessary time in the first week. He was focused on it this year. And the other thing that probably a lot of people haven't heard about is something which Ned was looking into earlier, which he'll explain now, which actually he had an operation a couple of years ago, which almost took a couple of years out of his career as he recovered from it.
I have to admit, I haven't listened to your Krauswijk special, which was a couple of days ago, wasn't it? Or you had a Dutch journalist talking about it. So forgive me for not, so if I'm repeating what he's already said. Well, I think it's critical to understanding where he's come from. So he finished in eighth place on the Giro in 2011. And then he's got, according to the Dutch media, in a three lost years, essentially. For a long time, his form dipped after that, and they couldn't get to the bottom of why. And it transpires that, and this is an affliction that, you know, a lot of riders suffer from because of the position they ride in repeatedly, that his femoral artery had collapsed basically at one point, I don't know which leg, but when they got to the bottom of that affecting his form, then he had to take the decision whether or not he'd undergo what is essentially a very dangerous operation. It can actually be life-threatening and certainly career-threatening if it goes wrong. When they take out the affected sort of pinched point of the artery, cut it out and reconnect the artery. It's as kind of like severe as that. And if that goes wrong, obviously your career is finished. And it takes a long time to recover from, get back to sort of full fitness. And really, he's only there now, and he's reaping the benefits from it. So that's some interesting background on Krauswijk. And the other point that they were making to me is that he is a rider who has been, I think I'm right in saying, with kind of Rabobank, then Blanco, you know, now Lotto. So he's been with that outfit for his entire career, which has a reputation of being quite Catholic in the Dutch Catholic sense. It's quite regimented, it's quite a conservative kind of approach. and that he's a rider who would have possibly benefited from moving on to a team that would have allowed him to express himself a little bit more. And of course, he's also lived in the shadow of Robert Hessing, hasn't he, as the main GC man on that team. But it's all coming good for him right now.
Is he going to win it?
Dan and I certainly hope so, for reasons that will remain unexplained. At this stage, yes, I mean, when a rider is going so well, you know, obviously there are concerns for all of the riders at this point, that with the final week on paper looking so hard, you know, there is the possibility, we've seen it before, that a rider reaches his form peak and then that form starts to dwindle in the last week. But I think it's a long way down to go from, as well as Kreuzweg is going at the moment, he's right on the pinnacle of that sort of form curve. And I don't see him losing enough in 1 week for it really to pose a problem. I think that he is at least going to be very, very good when it comes to next weekend over those high passes. And yeah, I'm fascinated by the issue of the altitude on this Giro d'Italia. I mentioned it several times in the podcast already. Kreuzweg, I know it's common practice now. Pretty much all the riders go to altitude before any major tour. Kreuzweg had this almost 3 week spell in Tenerife, did some huge days, 5,000 meters of climbing. We spoke yesterday about Chavez and, you know, the amount of time he spent at altitude, and of course having grown up at altitude. But I think that will be a factor in the last couple of days, and I think we might see a slightly different GC and a slightly different final GC to what we are accustomed to seeing, and riders going better than we expect and finishing higher than we expect, maybe because of that. Because, you know, when you go above 2,200, 2,300 meters, which we do several times in this race, a different kind of climber comes to the fore, perhaps. So Lionel, I'm looking for a fella called Joachim Rea, who is a very well-renowned cheesemaker in these parts. He's got a Malga or a Mazo dairy up here high in the mountains. I think that's him over there. I've just spotted him. So as a treat for your last day on the Giro, I'm going to take you to taste some cheese. This might shock you. I think Joachim is a native German speaker and might not even speak particularly good Italian.
Bei mir ist es so, wir sind eine Hofkäserei, die das ganze Jahr Käse durchmacht.
We are one of the few dairies that make cheese the whole year. My cheese is a full-fat milk cheese, which basically means we take the cheese from milk straight out of the cow. We've got 10 cows, so we're a very small operation. It's just me and my dad, really. My dad helps me in the stables and in the pastures, and I take care of the cheese making itself. Our dairy is 1,052 meters above sea level in the Dolomites. Our cows who live higher better at making cheese, just like cyclists who live higher are better at climbing mountains? Well, we have a special breed of grey cows which are smaller than regular breeds, and they love it at high altitudes. They don't give as much milk, but they're a lot healthier.
Bunte oder wie die braune geben nicht so viel Milch, sind aber dafür gesünder.
Lovely, lovely. I'm never going to turn down any cheese. I love cheese. Oh, it's nice, isn't it?
Come on, Lionel, some tasting notes.
Mild, it's creamy, lightly salted. Got a really nice texture. It's not hard, it's not soft, and it's not rubbery. It's kind of a Venn diagram of the three. It's a very pleasant cheese, yeah.
Well, Lionel, I'm sure you'd love to stay here all day eating cheese, but we've got a bike race to watch. We're going to thank Joachim. Joachim, vielen Dank.
It was cracking cheese, wasn't it, Daniel?
Well, you're the cheese expert, but it was belting cheese, Lionel.
It was. Lovely mountain cheese. I've got some currently melting and solidifying again in the footwell of the car. I'm not quite sure how that will be once it's got back to England, but find out tomorrow. I might have it on toast for tea.
And it was interesting that the cheese man, our cheese man that we heard from there, you noted that when you come to this part of Italy, as we've mentioned, it is Germanic, German being the first language, and people are slightly different demeanor. They seem to be a little bit more serious, a little bit more precise. Certainly, Ned is laughing. Why is Ned laughing?
Serious and precise, the German speaking people. I've never heard that observation before. It's remarkable.
Yeah, they don't really talk with their hands. They talk with a slide rule, don't they? You know, everything is measured out. Very, you know, they say exactly what they mean. There's no beating about the bush, is there? But we were marvelling at the Dolomites today, probably why we went so wrong with missing so many junctions and doing detours and all sorts. But Daniel, your kilometre zero explaining the definition of the Dolomites set me straight. I now sort of understand what the Dolomites are, but I've been blown away by the scenery. It's been a stunning few days on the Giro.
Yeah, me too, Lionel. It's my first time in this part of the world. Is it the same for you? it's my first Giro d'Italia as well, and obviously the race always comes here. But I just, you know, I'm very familiar with the French Alps and the Pyrenees, and to a certain extent, the Italian Alps over the other side of the country. But these are just on a different scale. They're absolutely beautiful. They're kind of like, you almost feel like you're in the Grand Canyon on occasions. Remarkable.
Dan, you were saying earlier that it's one of the most beautiful places in the world, and you've obviously ridden in a lot of places. I mean, for a rider, what are these climbs like?
I've tried to extinguish kind of all memories of how hard climbs over here are. In fact, I've ridden this climb before, but only when I went into the commentary box and did a bit of research today did I realise that this climb for the finish, or for the time trial today, was used as the finish of stage 5 of the 2009 Giro d'Italia, but I've got no recollection of it at all, and I certainly didn't take in any of the beautiful scenery here. But for yesterday's stage, won by Chavez, that is, as you probably will have mentioned, the scene of the Maratona each year. And I had the privilege of going over to do some videos with GCN at the Maratona a couple of years ago. And despite the fact that I've also had the privilege of going many other places in the world, you know, Colorado, all over France and Spain and Mallorca and all these beautiful places to ride, and it really did blow me away just how crisp everything looked and how different the mountains there looked, how good the roads were. You know, it really is an absolutely glorious place to ride. And the only thing about it is, it's quite a long way from any airport. So in terms of getting there, it's quite handy to have the Russian money to get a helicopter.
Well, what's that noise? It's that time of the evening again.
Voi grassi, spraito vinokrov. You fat, vinokrov yelled.
Well, Lionel, that was Vincenzo Nibali in his autobiography explaining how he was berated by Alexander Vinokourov, the Astana team manager. I noticed Vinokourov at the start this morning turn up with a flash new hairdo. He's been around for a couple of days now. And Vinokourov's admonishment seemed to have one of two effects on Vincenzo Nibali. Sometimes they galvanise him and sometimes he seems to sink. Do sharks sink? Do sharks swim? I think it really depends on...
This is a philosophical...
They definitely swim.
Yeah, it's a philosophical question.
However, I think that really sums it up. I mean, perhaps that is the origin of his nickname, Lo Squalo. You know, I mean, he either sinks emphatically or he swims. But Vinokourov has turned up. Nibali is not going well, is he? He's really struggling. He certainly really struggled today. Had a mechanical problem which hampered him. I actually thought he kept his cool fairly well there. And I thought a more inexperienced, a younger Vincenzo Nibali might have panicked there. It brought to mind Thibaut Pinot a couple of times in the Tour de France over the last 2 or 3 years. Last year on the cobbles, when Pinot had a problem, he kind of lost his head a little bit. I thought Nibali seemed to be getting nervous and upset about the whole situation, but his performance wasn't as bad, I think, as some people have made out. I mean, he lost... How much did he lose exactly?
Well, he started the day 41 seconds behind Kruijswijk, and he's ended it 2:51 behind. So he's lost two minutes, 10 seconds in 10.8 kilometres.
It was bad, but, you know, there's a bike change in there as well. You know, I'm not suggesting there was a problem specifically with the gears, but I think Nibali has had one or two problems with that this year. I'd be interested to get Dan's view on that. After that, I think he regrouped fairly well, and I don't think he's out of it by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, his entourage tonight, Beppe Martinelli, the DS, and Paolo Slonga, they both said that his form is okay, his condition is okay, but it was just an off day, really.
Dan, what do you make of Nibali's sort of... It's not been a great couple of days for him, really. I mean, if he'd ridden a bit more defensively yesterday, he may well have just ridden in with the Kruijswijk Chavez group, and today he's conceded time that you wouldn't have expected him to concede, notwithstanding the mechanical problem.
We talked yesterday, Ned and I, about what makes a champion, and we decided that it's someone who, on a bad day, maybe a little bit like yesterday where he lost 40 seconds, you know, a non-champion would have let their head drop and perhaps lose 2 or 3 minutes, whereas he, you know, couldn't quite keep up with Chavez and Kruijswijk, but he didn't let that affect his own performance and keeping on the race, and he minimised his time losses. I would personally say today was a really big blow to him. You know, notwithstanding the mechanical that he suffered, it looked like his gears were jumping. I said earlier in the commentary, actually, it looked like he'd had a little skip of the gears, and then a few moments later, it completely came off the rear mech as they tried to get the chain back onto the front chain set. He pedalled through and something got caught, and he completely ripped the rear mech away from the frame. Had to have a bike change, but we'd already had a graphic which we were trying to decipher, which was saying that Stephen Kreisweit had already put 1 minute and 40 seconds into him by that point, and that would tally quite well, because a further 30 seconds on from that, you know, with 2 minutes 10 that he lost on the stage, that's roughly what he probably would have lost by changing the bike.
Dan, we've kind of joked about it thus far in the Giro. We mentioned the fact that Nibali changed his crank length this year from 172.5 millimeters to 175 for several reasons. Could that make really a big enough difference to really unsettle a rider? I mean, he didn't make it on the eve of the Giro d'Italia, he didn't make that change then, but he's kind of been using these cranks for 3 or 4 months now. But could that really change things radically?
I wouldn't have thought so. We've seen quite a few riders recently go in the other direction, track riders specifically, the likes of, you know, Wiggins for the hour record and moving towards Rio. Alex Dowsett's gone down to 170s as well. So I'm not sure the reasoning behind Nibali going up, you know, 2.5 millimetres, but actually I don't think that would make much difference at all.
On tech, Dan, I don't know whether you noticed, but in La Gazzetta today, they had an interesting little snippet about the bikes at yesterday's, or after yesterday's mountain stage to Cordovada. Several bikes were weighed, as they often are in routine checks by the UCI. And most of the, certainly the leaders and the, you know, stage winner, Chavez, they were very close to the 6.8 UCI threshold. Team Sky's bikes were over 7.2 kilos. Quite a big difference.
I actually didn't see that in Gazzetta, but Pinarello's have never been known for being particularly light. I know that the riders absolutely love the way that they handle on descents. I've got no idea. I wouldn't have thought that Chris Froome's riding around at the Tour de France on a bike which concedes 400 grams to most other riders, but yeah.
No, I must admit that did shock me with, you know, the various component options that are available. I would suggest that it's not just a heavy frame that would mean that they're going, you know, that heavy. I'm sure they could get down to 6.8 if indeed they were that heavy yesterday.
Yeah, well, as I said, you know, 400 grams difference, that's certainly not down to the frame. I don't know the exact grams of the F8 which the Team Sky are using from Pinarello, but yeah, it's a bit of a surprise, because it seems like most manufacturers and most suppliers to the teams these days are capable of supplying a bike which is underneath the 6.8 kilogram limit, and lots of teams are having to add weights kind of artificially to make sure that it does come in above the UCI's minimum weight. So yeah, I have to say I'm not sure why it's coming in quite that heavy.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Without them, we wouldn't be here at the Giro d'Italia. They're sponsoring us not only here but all year, and they are particularly keen supporters of the Pedaleur de Charme Award, which is being awarded this week by Richard Moore, who's coming back out to the Giro on the rest day. But he's been, well, he's not really been watching, has he?
Probably not, Lionel.
Well, let's listen to Richard's nomination for today's Pedaleur de Charme.
I wonder how the spectators were interfering in that as well, because we saw Nibali was being interfered with ever so slightly by spectators. Now, Chavez...
Yeah, not another installment of the Shark's Tale. That was the voice of Rob Hatch on Eurosport. And Eurosport, of course, sponsor our daily Pedaleur de Charme segment. Lots of contenders again today. Very tough decision had to be made. Nibali was certainly a contender for the way that he dealt with some of the spectators who were, as Rob said, interfering with him on the climb, on the time trial. However, my Pedaleur de Charme for today is Andre Amador. He's gone very close other days. He gets it today for a picture that somebody tweeted us of him out on a ride, catching up with some young kids and giving one of them a nice push. That is the definition of Pedaleur de Charme. Well done, Andre Amador. We will give you your Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt when we next see you.
Well, Richard will be back when we resume on Tuesday with stage 16 of the Giro. I'm going home at the end of today. Very sad to be leaving. Ned, you've been here since the start. What have you made of the Giro? Is this the first time you've covered it in full?
Yes, it's. I've covered 13 or 14 tours. And, you know, I've been slightly kind of my career is, if you like, has been slightly kind of constrained by whatever ITV the broadcast have been working for, have kind of owned as in terms of broadcast rights up until now. In terms of Grand Tours, it's only been the Tour de France, so this is my first foray into the Giro d'Italia. And it's markedly different, isn't it, in almost every respect. There's a different attitude in the peloton. They're clearly kind of riders who are very focused on this and targeted, and this is their big season's objective. But because of where it falls in the season and that you've got two more Grand Tours still to come, you've always got the sense that riders have something up their sleeve if it all goes wrong. And you see that now with Mikel Landa, kind of potential that he might be riding for Chris Froome later on in the year. And that's not something you get with the Tour de France, where it's all in, isn't it? Kind of pretty much, and maybe you'll ride the Vuelta if you fancy it afterwards. So that's different. The entourage, it's smaller. There was a big crowd up here today, but it doesn't feel like anything like the kind of stress and the hubbub that surrounds the Tour de France. And I do remember talking to Steve Cummings, who's not on this race, a couple of years ago on the Tour de France, just kind of casually chatting to him, and he's saying how much he really dislikes the Tour de France and the whole environment and the stress that goes with it. And I think that kind of filters right the way down through the teams, doesn't it? And the way that the directeur sportif behave and the riders feel, and the media scrutiny is immense. I mean, Dan, who I'm working with here, has been, he's often said how he feels that it's extraordinary how much is expected of the pink jersey, the Maglia Rosa, in terms of their obligations at the end of the day. Well, I tell you what, that is nothing what Stephen Kreisweig had to put up with, as you know, and you know, Daniel, as well, compared to the Maillot Jaune on the Tour de France. It's a kind of pale comparison, arduous though it is. So it's a smaller race, but it's... I can see why people, you know, those cycling purists have always said, for me, it's the Giro. You know, I get why they say that. Sorry, just to complete that thought, though, I'm sure when July comes around, those same people might well be thinking, actually, it's about the Tour de France as well. You know, they're both great races in their own way.
And what about this race in particular? What sort of caught your eye in the first 2 weeks? What have you enjoyed the most?
I think I've enjoyed kind of the feeling that, and it's not just on this race, is it? But as the season progresses, and as the last couple of seasons have gone, actually, this sense of a changing of the guard that's kind of filtering right the way across the peloton and right the way across the likes of Julian Alaphilippe and Peter Sagan. Okay, he's been around for a good few years now, but we're on the cusp now, aren't we, of Gaviria coming to the fore in the sprinters' forum. You know, it's not long before Caleb Ewan starts winning big stages. Isn't it great that Bob Jungels has done what Bob Jungels has done? So reminiscent of Tom Dumoulin's journey of discovery on the Vuelta last year. And yeah, okay, so we can still reflect on Nibali and Alejandro Valverde, by the way, who we haven't mentioned today, who had a great ride today, actually. He's still very much in the frame. And they're all there still, but for how much longer? It feels like the cycling world is brushing its teeth and freshening up, and it smells good, it feels good.
Dan, what about from your perspective as a former rider? You've ridden the Giro and the Tour. Would you agree with what Ned says? Is there a bit less stress at the Giro, or is it actually harder to get through the stages? Because some of the stages have been really long, 210, 217. We've got 224 kilometres stage still to come. There's some long old days.
I think from a rider that was in my position back when I was racing, the differences are not so apparent as they are when you're on the other side of the fence, because not having to have the obligations of stage winners and riders that are leading classifications, you're very much shepherded the whole way through by your team bus from hotel to hotel, and then of course you're getting on the bike as well, and you know that feels fairly similar. As Ned said, the crowds aren't quite as big here at the Giro as they are at the Tour, so that there's that difference. But I have to say, the organisers have done a great job in designing the course this year. It's been, we've got 1 week to go, or six stages now in the Giro d'Italia, and it's only really been the last 2 days where we've had a clear hierarchy in the race and a clear look at who's really got the form to win the Giro. And I guess you might say that it's the dominance of maybe Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins firstly, and then Chris Froome after that, that they've obliterated the first mountain stage. But I think even if they'd been here with somebody in that form, they wouldn't have had the opportunity to do that so far in this race. And so from that point of view, there's a lot still to come, and that's a great thing for the fans.
Is that because on the Tour you get a climb, a descent, and then a valley road, and then a climb, a descent, and valley road? Perhaps not in the Pyrenees, but certainly in the Alps. Here, looking at the profiles and driving some of the courses, yesterday in particular, it was up, down, up, down. There's not as much opportunity really to get a team on the front and just basically strangle the race.
Yeah, it's like, sorry, just to butt in there. It's like the Tour de Yorkshire on steroids. to a certain extent, isn't it? I mean, it is
steady, Ned.
You know,
steady.
That's the race that Daniel and I have been working on together, actually, for broadcast purposes. But you get what I'm saying. It's been kind of narrow roads. It's been up and down. Stage four was brilliant, wasn't it? I thought, and that's kept it tight.
It's like watching the Tour of Yorkshire. Tour de Yorkshire is becoming the cycling equivalent of the ironic football chant. It's like watching Brazil.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring us during the Giro d'Italia. Any listeners to the cycling podcast who cycle or run or want energy drinks, bars and gels can get 20% off Science in Sport products by visiting scienceinsport.com and entering SIS20, that's SIS20, when they check out, and they can get 20% off and have everything delivered to their door. So thank you to Science in Sport.
Now that you mention one of our sponsors, I was also going to mention the providers of our music, our fantastic theme tune on this Giro d'Italia, Amar a Terra, and I've been meaning for a few days to explain the origin of the name of the kind of music that they produce. It's pizzica music from Salento in Puglia, and pizzica is actually a bite in Italian, and a legend has it that pizzica music originated because shaking your body vigorously was the only way to evacuate the toxins that came from a tarantula bite. There were apparently tarantulas in that part of the world down in the heel of Italy. I don't know how many centuries ago. But yeah, that's where the name pizzica comes from. And Amar a Terra are making very nice and very evocative pizzica music for us.
Daniel, were you going to take issue with something Dan Lloyd said there?
We're going to see or hear a very rare thing on the cycling podcast, an argument. I was going to quibble with what Dan said about the route. I agree with him that it's been set up perfectly for maximum drama. However, right from when the route was presented the day after the Tour of Lombardy last year, I was very worried about these penultimate two stages, the one to Risul on Friday and to Sant'Anna di Vinadio the day after. Going to go over 2,000 metres and well over 2,000 metres four times, and it almost feels like Mauro Vegni, the race organiser, is standing in an alpine meadow doing a snow dunk, tempting fate, egging the weather on, saying, come on, do your worst, because he really is... he's taking a big gamble, isn't he? Some of these passes are often not open at this time of year. The Agnello in particular on Friday we're due to do, it's 2,744 metres. It is open, but we've had, this is another great thing about the Giro, the kind of unconfirmed stories, the salacious rumours. There have been unconfirmed rumours, stories, mocked up photographs of in the style of kind of fake moon landings of snow on the Colle dell'Agnello. A lot of talk today about the possibility of the Agnello and maybe the Bonnet the following day being closed and the race possibly having to be rerouted, which would be absolutely terrible for the race. And I just think it's unnecessary. I mean, I was speaking to Mario Scirea, who's the Lampre Merida Direct Sportif this morning, and he still feels the Giro is too extreme from that point of view. There's no need in a country that is full of fantastic climbs to go and do the Agnello in, well, the last week of May. It's not even the last week of May, is it?
Well, particularly with you know, the extreme weather protocol and the fact that the precedent was set in Tirreno Adriatico, wasn't it, when the snow was falling on the roads and settling on the roads and the stage was cancelled the day before. And I think on the day it probably would have been just about okay, but the decision was taken partly because the teams of workers couldn't get the infrastructure for the race out while the snow was all falling. So yeah, I see your point there. I mean, Dan, on the extreme weather protocol, I mean, will the riders will be sort of nervously anticipating what the weather forecast will be on those 2 days, I guess.
Luck now will play its role in terms of the weather that we're going to experience this next week. Daniel's right, you know, it could easily have been terrible weather towards the end of May. We've seen snow in the past, and a couple of years ago in the Giro d'Italia stage was completely cancelled. They had to rerun it last year because obviously the towns that had paid to host the start and finishes, you know, wanted it back the following year. Let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that it is good weather. We had some fantastic weather the last 2 days, slightly chillier than you looked like you were expecting at the top of this climb today, but for the riders, I think we'll be very happy with what they've experienced so far in terms of weather.
I've got a little Col de la Bonnette story, which is one of the climbs you were talking about, which goes over, what is it, 2,700 metres. I think it's the highest paved road in Europe. There's always a bit of...
Don't get me started on this, Balto. Is it not? I guarantee that everyone will say on, when is it? Saturday, that it's the highest climb, it's the highest pass in Europe. However, the pass itself, so we're only going to 2,715 metres. That is the pass. You can go higher, you can go to 2,802 metres, but it's really only what they call a panoramic road. It's a loop around the summit, not really a pass.
I tried to ride it in late May in 2007 or something like that for the telly, and I didn't get to the top because it was snowed up. I mean, significantly far from the top, actually 8K or something from the top. It was heavy, heavy snow. And I when I reached the point where I had to turn around because there was just snow all over the road, I came to a halt and I could hear gunshots all around the snowfields. And I became aware that, like, yomping down the snowfields towards me were an entire division of French infantry. And they were using it, the French soldiers there, as a basically an open firing range. I hope the ammunition wasn't live, but they were practicing a division from Bordeaux who were about to be deployed in Afghanistan.
Wow. Well, we should really hear from Maravegni on that bellicose note, shouldn't we? I spoke to Maravegni in the press room in Alpe di Siusi tonight to get his reaction to those rumours, those salacious rumours of snow on the Colle dell'Agnello. Maravegni, of course, being the race director here at the Giro d'Italia.
Who told you there was snow? If you want, I can show you photos of the passes, and they're open. I got it confirmed to me 2 days ago that the passes are open on the French and the Italian sides. If tomorrow it snows and the day after tomorrow, then it's another story. Of course there's a plan B for both stages. The relevant local authorities all know what it is and are prepared, but we can't tell you what it is.
Well, there's form here, isn't there, Daniel? The most famous example would be, was it the 1984 Giro when Francesco Moser, who was a good climber but not a great climber, was trying to win the Giro ahead of a Frenchman called Laurent Fignon. There was all sorts of shenanigans in the mountains. And did they doctor the images of the snow blocked passes, or is that another one of the myths? But they rerouted us.
It was rerouted when there were supposedly TV pictures of the passes in question. I think it was the Stelvio. It was either the Stelvio or the Gavia being completely clear of snow.
Yeah, so the roads were clear, but they rerouted the race anyway. And I think, yeah, maybe if Nibali needs those climbs to be open, they will be open. And if he doesn't, they won't. Shall we wrap it up there? That's the end of my Giro d'Italia after 2 weeks. I've enjoyed it tremendously. Richard will be back on Tuesday to see the race through to Turin with you, Daniel.
Well, thank you, Lionel. It's been a pleasure travelling with you the last few days.
Well, you said that almost as if you meant it. But thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you to our guest this evening, Dan Lloyd. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure to be with you on the podcast.
And Ned Bolting.
Cheers, Lionel. See you back in the Blighty at some point.
And enjoy the final week, chaps. Thank you.